Football on Off the Ball.
With Sky. Watch every single live Premier League game on Sky Sports, BT Sport and Premier Sports.
Now, great to have you along for the football show. So later on, Rob Harris is going to join us. Rob, of course, is the global sports correspondent for Associated Press. And he will tell us about the FIFA / Arsene Wenger plan to bring into effect a biennial World Cup. So from 2028, really, Wenger wants World Cup in 28, Euros in 29 in this part of the world. Obviously, it'd be Copa America elsewhere and so on. And then back to a World Cup in 30, Euros in 31, World Cup in 32, Euros in 33, World Cup in 34. You get the idea. You don't have to be John Nash to see the pattern there. So will it happen? It seems there is a pretty good chance, increasingly, that FIFA have the numbers, because obviously one vote, one country, and lots of countries like the sound of this. It gives them a chance of finally making a World Cup, and they should, it seems, have the vote. So it might come down to what extent UEFA, the clubs, the various leagues are willing to potentially boycott or drag their heels in various ways. So Rob Harris from Associated Press is going to join us later on. Not sure to what extent semi-finals of the UEFA Nations League are gripping you, but first one on this evening. Italy 0, Spain 2 after 57 minutes. Ferran Torres with both goals for Spain. I just mentioned that before 9 o'clock news. I'd watched a couple of recent Spanish qualification games, just happened to catch them, and Ferran Torres, in the way he did for Man City, for instance, against Spurs away, was leading the line for Spain. His record is pretty good for Spain, you have to say. So two goals this evening, that brings him up to 12 goals in 21 games, which is not bad at all. 21-year-old Ferran Torres. So he's scoring for Spain, and two this evening against Italy. Not bad at all. We do have Ireland against Azerbaijan on Saturday. Very happy to bring in Mr. David Snaid. Hello, David. How are you doing?
Evening, Joe. What's the story?
All good. I mean, we will talk about the game. I think really that is the plan. Callum Robinson swooped in and grabbed everybody's attention, I think, yesterday, and he's on front pages, back pages of all the papers today, current affairs shows all over this. Mm-hmm. For people who still haven't heard the audio, we don't have to labour the point, I think, too much, but here is Callum Robinson in his press conference yesterday, and he was asked about the vaccination, which obviously he isn't taking at the moment, which was the big talking point.
My honest opinion would be it's your choice. Like, I wouldn't be to say everyone should be vaccinated or you shouldn't get vaccinated. I think it's your personal choice. If you want to be vaccinated, then go do it. But if you don't want to, it is what it is. It's everyone's choice. I can't tell people to get it, and I can't tell people not to.
What's your personal choice, Kyle? Have you decided to get vaccinated?
I haven't been vaccinated yet, no. So that's my choice at this moment in time.
Some people might think that's unusual given your own personal health experiences recently.
Yeah, of course. As I said, it's obviously annoying that I've caught it twice, but I haven't been vaccinated. Further down the line, I could change my mind and want to do it, but at this moment in time, I haven't been vaccinated. No.
Do you mind asking why you didn't do that?
I just haven't done it. I think, as I said to you, man, here, it's your personal choice, and my choice at this moment in time, I haven't been vaccinated. I know, as you said, there's managers and people that will want you to do it, which is right in their way of what they think, but everyone has their choice and what they want to do. I wouldn't force it on people to do it or not. It's your choice. It's your body.
Cue the last 24 hours. Difficult to talk too much about Robinson, David, because really there, when he's asked for any kind of reason, his answer was, I just haven't. And that was all he said, really. So where he is on the spectrum of somebody who just hasn't maybe bothered to inform themselves too much versus somebody at the other end of the spectrum who has done nothing but read into it and look into every article they could find. We don't really know where he is or what his rationale is. I mean, certainly he's taken a lot of criticism in the last 24 hours, that much you can say.
Yeah, I'm stuck between two stools a little bit in terms of, I kind of feel a bit sorry for him in the sense of he's been put out there and he's been open enough and he's obviously spoken about it and said he's not vaccinated and he's getting all sorts of pelters now in terms of if it's different radio shows and all the rest of it. I think was it one radio host later on was saying that he's now caught COVID more times than he scored for Ireland, which I thought was a bit below the belt. It was really interesting because from a personal point of view, I can't really defend him because I personally would be of the opinion that I think you have a responsibility to be vaccinated, but then again, I can't really force your opinion on somebody else. It's the fact that, I suppose, and it was the nature of when he was speaking, I wasn't in the room myself for this part of the press conference, it was a kind of a group setting, so it's kind of maybe difficult to properly get into it in terms of maybe if it was a one-on-one setting, you could have maybe elaborated a bit more, maybe he wasn't given that opportunity. But I just found just a little bit today, even just after obviously with Callum Robinson, and then obviously coming on to speak about it, just it was interesting just getting in touch with people at Premier League clubs, and it's an interesting one. People talking about bubbles, like there's a lot of people. I can say it now. It's 9:10. There's a lot of people, almost at Premier League clubs, people I've spoken to, who are a bit pissed off about what they still have to go through in terms of what's happening, which I actually found a bit interesting and a bit surprising in terms of when I was reaching out to people today, and like
go through as in COVID protocols.
Yeah, but there was kind of like a sense that one of the points was made to me is like it was almost as if they were told, like, well, there's not actually a benefit of getting as a sports person because they're still getting tested twice a week in Premier League clubs. Like, that's what, speaking to someone at a Premier League club today, they were kind of under the impression, well, get the vaccine and then they don't have to deal with all the protocols and what they have to be, as they were put it, almost going through with the rigorous testing, like still twice a week, and the social distancing that they still have to do around training and kind of wearing masks and around the training ground and stuff like that. And I did find that a bit interesting, but then when you hear them talking about it, and like they're in this little bit of a bubble, and you kind of, they're even people who always been getting the sense that at this point they almost feel as if it's just about keeping the show on the road with the Premier League and keeping the money rolling in, that they feel as if they're seeing the fact that in the UK life is getting essentially back to normal. And not that I have sympathy for them, but like I was over at a game, first time over in England at a game at the weekend, and it just struck me even beforehand, being around the ground and like being in a very enclosed space, like full of people having a few drinks and stuff, and then obviously everything, the protocols in Premier League are so rigorous, like life has effectively returned to normal in the UK, and they're seeing that it's not the case. And obviously around the clubs, and they're still doing all the testing. I think I almost get the sense that sometimes maybe if they got the vaccine they wouldn't have to be tested or what it was, you know. It's, I just found it a bit bizarre, you know.
It does seem to be the dynamics of the thing. It does seem to depend what club you're at. So in the Premier League, for instance, I mentioned these stats earlier, but just for anyone who wasn't listening, Premier League, 20 clubs, 7 have more than 50% fully vaccinated. So obviously the other 13 don't. If you're in the Wolves dressing room, they're at 100%. If you're at Leeds, 99%. If you're at Liverpool, 99%. Which, by the way, is better than the UK uptake of 89%. So they're way above average, whereas for instance if you're at Manchester United, which was reported on over the last couple of days, you're well below 50%. Thought it was interesting that the PFA chief executive came out and urged the players not to believe all the myths and the lies online, and that's the PFA chief executive coming out saying that. And just like two different quotes to throw at you, and they're both from club doctors, one anonymous, the other is the Rochdale team doctor, Dr. Wesley Tensel, who said, I think one of the reasons for the low uptake this is social media, the anti-vax stuff that's bandied around. It does get passed around the changing room. Football changing rooms are different to most workplaces. They're all together. It's an echo chamber. So if one of the senior players or an influential person has seen something on social media and that's passed to somebody else, they're not necessarily likely to critically appraise where that's come from, and they end up going down a rabbit hole. That was the Rochdale team doctor. And then the Daily Mail spoke to a club doctor who remained anonymous. And it was interesting there. You got a sense of a club doctor almost banging his or her head against the wall. It's very frustrating. It's hard to know what to do, as the conspiracy theories have really taken hold in some dressing rooms. We've got senior players, intelligent men, coming out with all sorts of nonsense, and they won't be budged. One of them told me he didn't need the vaccine because he could boost his immunity by taking vitamins. Some of the stuff they're reading and believing on the internet's incredible. Players saying it will make them infertile, that it's part of a plot involving Bill Gates, that the pandemic is just propaganda. The real problem is that they're also polluting the minds of younger players. So that's about the best insight we have into what's going on in certain football dressing rooms. And obviously, Irish players playing their football in England may not be immune to some of that. Now, by the way, I don't know where Callum Robinson is, and I don't like going after one player, individualising this, making this all about one person. He didn't give his reasons, so we don't know where his head is at, but certainly that's what the various doctors are saying. Doctors, by the way, ironically, who I'm sure players take their advice in a very unquestioning way most of the time. Take that injection, take that pill, do this, do that. I'm sure they do it in the main. So frustration seemed to be the order of the day there.
Yeah, and again, and even just from, again, from speaking to people today, one person put it to me is that it's almost, he was making the point that this hesitancy isn't something that's new. Like that, for as long as he's been around football, like there's lads, players who won't get the flu jab around the time of year they should, you know what I mean? That there's even stuff around that where that's how it was put to me as well. Obviously, listen, it's COVID and it's a pandemic, and there's the amount of people who, thousands of people around the world who've lost their lives. You would have liked to have thought that people would be kind of respecting the views that are given to by club doctors and stuff. And one of the things, and what you said there about the fact that it's gone from club to club, and I was thinking about this over the last couple of days, if you kind of look at how what's happened in the Premier League over the last couple of years, more so over the last year, in terms of even with, say, COVID and the whole Black Lives Matter movement, where the Premier League captains all got together and they seemed to be really on the same page with a lot of stuff. They were able to actually have that, find a common voice together. And it was a Jordan Henderson, a Seamus Coleman and stuff, kind of seemed to be actually leading the way with that in terms of doing Zoom calls around the return to play with the Premier League as well, when was it Project Restart? That's what it was called, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And stuff that was happening as well around this. And that's sort of something that I'm surprised maybe hasn't, the PFA maybe haven't tried to do, or again, it's something that I haven't been made aware of that maybe they have, because it did seem for a while as if a lot of the club captains, when it came to serious issues, actually were being proactive and were actually getting ahead of stuff and making sure that dressing rooms were fully informed on certain aspects and finding a common voice on something. So that's something that I'm surprised maybe hasn't happened. And perhaps it is what you're saying about dressing rooms. Again, it was a point that was made to me as well, is that there'd be people in dressing rooms who won dressing rooms, and there could be a certain number of players in a dressing room, and if they what they say kind of goes, and some lads could be, again, you can kind of say this is Callum Robinson's reason, because he didn't maybe expand on it, and it's almost unfair on him because he's put his head above the parapet here now to kind of be used as the poster boy for it. But like, there will be lads who are sheep and will just follow. We don't know. And like, and it's just from a personal point of view, I do find it quite strange. Like, listen, we all probably have maybe friends and who maybe might be a bit skeptical, and you make your own mind up, and you listen to the experts. That's how I've kind of tried to live it by the last while and gone off, and you would think that's what footballers would do as well. But listen, clearly, when you look at the numbers and you listen to the different stories, and even just from speaking to people today, you kind of just get the sense that it is a bit of a different world for some of these lads. There's no getting away from it. It really is.
It seems to be creeping up, vaccination rates, by the way. BBC looked at the English Football League outside of the Premier League, and so they were at 18% uptake in August, and they jumped to 50% in September. So maybe it's creeping up slowly but surely. One last one of this, because again, I think we could talk about this all day, and ultimately it's tricky territory in some respects. We've just followed the advice. Beyond that, our expertise is limited. But from a media point of view now, I'd say Callum Robinson walked out today not thinking this was coming, and maybe sleptwalked into it, or last night rather, and suddenly kind of leaves the press conference a little ashen-faced and thinking, oh my God, I'm going to be all over the place tomorrow. Like, is it now just going to become the norm that, like, every Ireland player who's interviewed is asked, and have you been vaccinated? And every Premier League player who, you know, is in the mix zone, and have you been vaccinated? Like, is this appropriate? Is this where it's going to go? Does this kind of just wither a bit as time goes on? Like, what's fair here?
I don't know. Like, well, personally, in terms of what's fair, from a professional point of view, if I was sitting down with a player for a one-on-one interview and was wanting to go into in depth as an in terms of talking about different topics, yeah, it would be something that I would bring up. Not, I wouldn't be coming straight out and saying, "Are you vaccinated?" But like, it's literally a topic that you cannot avoid in terms of COVID over the last while because it's what's happened. Like, so if you're sitting down one-on-one with someone, it of course is something that you're going to bring up. I think with Callum Robinson, it was natural that some talk would have came to COVID because of what's happened, the fact that he's missed games because of it and he's had it twice. So I think in that instance, it's kind of, there's a natural, from a work point of view, like there's a natural way you have, like it's a question that's, he should have been expecting, I would imagine, or before he was going in, as tends to be the case now when players are brought in, they are kind of, I'm guessing, have a briefing of, kind of, well, what's happening, maybe what to expect, not so much exactly the question, but they'll probably be told, and as you know this yourself, like they probably get told a bit of a briefing of, listen, X, Y, and Z, just be prepared for maybe some kind of topic on it. So you would imagine he would have been given the heads up on it. It's interesting actually because of what happened. I know the 21s were doing stuff that the Ireland under 21s was originally supposed to be in person today, and then because of what happened and the coverage, and I think certain journalists maybe not feeling 100% comfortable over the fact that they maybe with someone who isn't vaccinated and all the rest of it, that was in, then switched to be doing by Zoom, right. I think, rather than personal stuff. And like we are kind of getting into a point where everything is being done over Zoom in terms of press conferences. It's beginning, obviously this was the week where things were actually beginning to get back to normal and in person, and it's kind of like, it's been a strange one over the last while in terms of, from a point of view of myself, in terms of working, like kind of, like there have been times where I've been gone over and doing interviews before COVID, and you're getting to stay with a subject for a weekend and sleeping on their couch kind of thing, and you're kind of developing a bit of a niche from a professional point of view of doing that, and then you're like, the chances of getting something like that again are almost impossible. But then at the same time, because Premier League clubs are doing everything via Zoom over the last while, you've actually got the chance to be involved in maybe more press conferences than you would have been able to in terms of getting over to the UK. So there's been some kind of benefits to that way. I can't see it being something that's going to dominate every single press conference from now on, asking the player, are they vaccinated? But like, I imagine maybe with the FAI now say they know, which I'm guessing they know which players are, they might even suss it out and then maybe not put up players who weren't, just in case it is. And this is the thing as well, and without getting too much into it, and listen, I know things have been pretty changed in terms of the culture with the FAI and media and stuff, but for so long you were getting the same players put up to do media because they were the ones who were happy to talk and would be willing to actually say yes and do it. Whereas, I don't know, that was the case with Callum Robinson, because obviously the kind of rote is almost of what which players are put up. But if that's the case, where they'll only put up players maybe who are vaccinated in terms of in-person press conferences, that could be something that might happen down the line. I don't know. But yeah. I'm guessing it's something that now will be, obviously, you know, the FA released a statement, didn't they, as well, talking about the testing and stuff that's being done in terms of public health and UEFA protocols and stuff. So it's, it's...
What about the match itself? So I guess this has been a big 24-hour storm, and quickly on Saturday, the match will take precedence, certainly for a couple of days anyway, because there's just a huge degree of pressure on Stephen Kenny now.
But he has to win. As people say, this game, I feel, is it like obviously the results, but he just has to win this game. He just, a point of view of, just my point of view of, we're saying, I think I've spoken to you numerous times over the last while. Obviously, you want to see development, but I think at this stage, you just need to get a result. I don't think it's necessarily a case of you throw out the kind of blueprint you've been working towards and try and get a result hook or by crook. I think he needs to stick by his guns and stick with his convictions and how he wants this Ireland team to play. But it just has to work in this game. Like, he can't afford, Ireland can't afford, and Stephen Kenny can't afford just for his own, even at this point, just for more of the credibility point of view at this point, he just needs to get a result just to buy himself a bit of breathing space with people who and critics who rightly over the results just obviously do not want them to be manager anymore. And but people need to, he needs to get a result just purely as well, because like he can't keep on making the same excuses time and time again and talk about building for the future, which is great in what he has to do, and I do believe in what he's been trying to do, but at some point, and it needs to just kind of crystallize with a result at this point in the campaign, just to give him breathing space, because that's what he needs now. Because a poor result against Azerbaijan on Saturday, and in the mood going into that friendly against Qatar, like, it's almost like it's a pointless game then. Like, if you consider where the kind of maybe the last half an hour or so of that Serbia game, and the kind of energy that did seem to be in the stadium, and a bit of the belief that maybe he was there by getting that last minute pretty late result, I think people were beginning to buy into it then again, and have a bit more confidence, and they were seeing some of the players like Andrew Omobamadeli and obviously Gavin Bazunu and stuff. But if they can kick on a little bit and just show that bit, it's just going to be a really, really difficult situation.
Yeah, and like Tuesday would have the potential to be very messy indeed if they lost to Qatar as well, and then the full-time whistle, and it just gets difficult then on a few fronts.
I kind of think as well, if you look at, say, that last international window, obviously the three games, like, I think there's enough positives that have come from that I don't think it's a case of coming into this campaign thinking it's so downbeat. It's downbeat because of whatever everything else that's happened.
It could turn, though. I think Serbia definitely was, that was their best window for sure. And Serbia, even before they scored the goal, there was a bit of support. But I think a defeat in Azerbaijan, everybody watching at home on a miserable Saturday evening, I think the atmosphere could be different on Tuesday at the Aviva. Azerbaijan, so I mentioned this to Damien Delaney, they're 117th in the world. For the last 22 games and counting, they haven't scored more than a goal a game. And Ireland's defence, actually, there's a bit of strength. You know, you would feel okay about it the way it's performed more recently. The problem, as ever, is can Ireland score a goal? And the only goal, really, of any note across this entire campaign was their very first one against Serbia, the Callum Robinson cross and the Brown header. Everything else has been Egan header, Duffy header, OG, Collins after keepers chase down, like nothing really, and like no goals against Luxembourg. So Ireland scoring is what this comes down to a little bit on Saturday. Let's presume for a second Ida's in. Conley, even though Kenny did say his career has stalled a bit, which was telling, Conley's in, and Robinson will be a big player for them. Like, you'd feel there's a bit of creativity there. You've got to feel there's some goals there, surely.
I don't know. Like, yeah, you would. Like, you're saying that, like, Callum Robinson, we had a good start to the season, but he's got quite a number of games now. I think it's 6 or 7 games now in the championship without a goal in terms of creativity. Like, Adam Eder,
he's getting no game time. We only ever seen him for Ireland, really.
That's the thing. And listen, I've made this point numerous times though as well, is that like these are the issues that plenty of Ireland managers have had to deal with over the last while, in terms of obviously the game time, but also the fact that maybe having to chop and change, because you're very rarely ever going to be able to have the same starting 11 throughout a whole campaign and the rest of it. But in terms of goals, like, if you look back to that Azerbaijan game, obviously, and I thought it was interesting in the interview that Keith Andrews kind of gave with you, I think it was a bit of an insight that he kind of said he don't think he expected an Azerbaijan player to be capable of scoring that goal. The fact that Cullen and Coleman did it in terms of closing them down and almost said, right, go on, have your shot. Whereas I think he made the point that if it was, say, Bruno Fernandes or someone stepping over that ball, they would have maybe been out to him a bit quicker. So there was obviously a little bit, an element of taking them a bit lightly in that regard, which they were punished for. I don't know, it's made because of the last while, like, it's, and it's the issues with the Ireland team over the last while, it just is scoring goal. Like, I personally think a set piece will be what will decide it for Ireland. Like, I know you said earlier about, well, but the set pieces, but some of the goals have actually been good. Like, the John Egan goal was a well-worked set piece, and they are very important parts of football. And it is something, and again, I've made this point continuously as well, like, despite the fact that I think people think that, like, Stephen Kenny has come into the job and wants to do away with set pieces or something that he doesn't want them. But, like, they're one of his biggest weapons as manager of Dundalk. Do you know what I mean? Like, he puts such an emphasis on it. So, I personally do think that's what it'll come down to. Will be maybe a set piece or working a ball into a good area in a box and maybe getting Ida on the end of it. That could be a way and get through, because it's not going to be like an away game, say, against Portugal, where Ireland were able to have a real sharp counter-attack plan and put it into really good use, and were able to properly play well in that game, not just like backs against the wall job. Like, they were able to hoard Portugal down each flank, particularly the left, where Connolly could have maybe even scored a goal in the first half. It's not going to be like that against Azerbaijan. It's going to be a game where they're going to have to try and break them down. And creativity in open play is something that Ireland just, they have a serious lack of.
Yeah.
And maybe if Jamie McGrath keeps his place in the team, again, I think he has got that bit of a pass in him, and he also is good from set pieces. Like, you're probably thinking it's going to be three at the back with the wing backs. You're going to be hoping Matt Doherty and possibly Enda Stevens, who obviously played in 90 minutes for Sheffield United last week and has been back in around for the last month or so with Sheffield United. You would think maybe getting in down those flanks will also be a big thing, because there won't be an awful lot of space in the round. Obviously, Will Keane, will he be a bit of a curveball? And then obviously Troy Parrott as well. He played the game, as it was the home game, obviously with Connolly out on the left, and kind of try to use Parrott as the 10. So that's personally where I think it's going to be. I think it's going to be a set piece. I think at this moment that's probably going to be their best opportunity. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I guess they probably take it at this stage given the situation. David Snaith, thanks so much. And by the way, I know you've a really good interview with James McLean on the 42. 10 years on from his debut in English football, that whisp by, so people can check that out.
He's the oldest player in the squad in that match. Hey,
David, thanks a mil.
No worries, Joe. Take care.
Cheers. David Snaith there. Football on Off the Ball, brought to you by Sky. All the football you love in one place across Sky Sports, BT Sport and Premier Sports. We're talking to Rob Harris next.
Football on Off the Ball.
With Sky. Watch every single live Premier League game on Sky Sports, BT Sport and Premier Sports.
Now, you're welcome back. Very happy to say Rob Harris joins us on the line. He is the global sports correspondent for Associated Press. Rob, hello.
Hello, good to see you.
Great to have you on. So we've been meaning to do a piece on Arsene Wenger and his biennial World Cup idea for some time. Arsene Wenger these days, of course, is FIFA's chief of global football development. And so he wants biennial tournament. Really, he launched this maybe 3-4 weeks ago. In the main, I would think, to raised eyebrows and negativity from various stakeholders in the game. But then, to be fair, not universal slamming of his ideas either. So in so much as you can, give us the nuts and bolts here, what Wenger is proposing.
Yeah, what a complicated process this is, in the sense of how we've reached the point where FIFA seems on the verge of, in UEFA's words, really railroading through biennial World Cups. And this was an idea that started with the FIFA president, Gianni Infantino. It was then nominally proposed at the FIFA Congress in May by the Saudi Arabian Federation to be put forward for approved of a feasibility study, which of course went through by more than 160 of the 211 FIFA member associations, many of course who never get to go to a World Cup, many who are very supportive always of the FIFA president. And then Wenger was asked by Infantino and the organisation to lead the study into biennial World Cups to try to also win support for it. We then reached the point in early September where Wenger lays out his plans initially in an interview with L'Equipe, then in the days later with more of us journalists as well. And it becomes clear that Arsene Wenger wants a World Cup every 2 years for men. What's very clear at that point is they hadn't even really seemed to factor in the impact on the women's game or even a women's World Cup every 2 years as well. And we sort of go through the month of September and we've had opposition from UEFA, the European Club Association, European Leagues Organization, all about the detrimental impact on the game of the shake-up with biennial World Cups, with potentially only two international windows now, one for the June-July tournament, another for October and November, where you'd play the other fixtures like qualifiers for the national teams. And it was only last Thursday that all the 211 member associations got a chance to hear the presentation themselves from Wenger and FIFA, even though that was like 3 weeks after we'd got it. So you can see now why, you know, there is some unease, particularly around the likes of UEFA, about their belief that they've not even been properly consulted on this while FIFA are trying to push through plans that would overhaul football. And you've got CONMEBOL in South America also opposed to these plans. Intriguingly, they themselves in 2018 proposed this themselves, World Cup every 2 years. But since then, they've moved away from them as they've got closer aligned to UEFA.
So a couple of questions jump to mind. I suppose I'd be, in, before we get too into the weeds of this idea, it'd be nice to get an idea for how likely it is to come to pass. Like Wenger was talking about how we could have this up and running by World Cup 2028. And I suppose in this neck of the woods, it would be World Cup in 28, the Euros in 29, World Cup in 30, Euros 31, and on we go forevermore. So I guess a couple of questions. One, how likely is it to pass at FIFA Congress next May, which is ultimately, I think, where this thing may be voted on? And if FIFA passes at their Congress next May, does that mean world football at large just has to go along with it? Like UEFA hate this and the various club leagues hate this, but is there anything they can do if FIFA voted through?
Well, the question is, do UEFA go through with their threat of a boycott? They've said that actually the teams wouldn't take part in a World Cup, but we've already had France saying that they're yet to decide either way. Germany and Portugal have come out against World Cup every 2 years. England's been cautious at this stage, even though the FA's women's division has come out against the plans because of the impact on the women's game, particularly because if you did have a World Cup every 2 years and a continental championship in the alternate years, then no longer would there be the odd numbers years, the preserve of women's tournaments in those summers with the women's Euros, for instance, and also the World Cup. So it really encroach into that territory. But the decision could come even sooner than May, because FIFA could hold a meeting in December to get approval for this. And then that would really accelerate the sense of the opposition from UEFA. But we have gone through some of this before. In 2019 in particular, UEFA were opposing the Club World Cup expansion plans by FIFA. Then they went and accepted them on the basis of 8 rather than 12 European teams. And they've been making all sorts of threats against FIFA on this. So there is precedent for the bark being pretty loud from UEFA, but then in reality, they aren't quite as tough. So it's interesting to see how then this does unfold, because FIFA could seemingly get this through from a vote of its membership, because there is that widespread support across Africa. We sense from, you know, other parts of Asia as well, where FIFA's already garnered support. But there are so many questions just over the process and how they've reached this point. The thing is, FIFA does need some sort of agreement on the international match calendar. It expires for women in 2023, for men in 2024. So a new calendar is needed. And the calendar is what mandates clubs to release players to international duty. It sets in stone all those windows through the year when you're meant to have qualifiers or tournaments. So it's really crucial for the running of the global game between the international part of football and the club part.
Yeah, the damage it would do to the women's game notwithstanding for a moment, because I think actually that could become a bigger and bigger issue for FIFA to explain away, and rightly so. But Arsene Wenger's a very serious man. Listening to his many, many press conferences over 20 years at Arsenal was generally one of the more interesting ways to spend 15 minutes if you were forced to go through managerial press conferences. So I think when it was Wenger at the forefront here, a lot of people would have said, okay, well, let's stop and listen to what he has to say. There are some fair points in this. Like, I think the reality is the international calendar does need to be redefined. At the moment, as you mentioned earlier on, we have international windows in September, then we go again in October, which we're in at the moment, then there'll be another in November, then in March. It's very dragged out, it's incredibly dull, and then in June there are either friendlies or different countries get together and organise tournaments of their own, and there's lots of travel. So in terms of player welfare, you know, there's a huge amount of travel there. Like, we often again think of, well, Irish players nipping back on the flight from Heathrow or from Manchester, but I mean, South American players playing in European leagues, having to trek over 15, 20 hour flight, come back a few days later, play a Premier League game, do it all again in November, do it all again in March, is unsustainable in many ways, not to mention the environment, if that increasingly is going to become an issue as well. So I have to say, there is something in the idea of almost this mini international tournament he's proposing. So instead of all these international windows, all the interruptions to, say, the Premier League, which everybody's enjoying, in October, you have four teams, a group in effect, you'd have a maximum of 7 matches, depending on playoffs and everything else. And that would be how you would qualify for the major tournament the following summer. And you could imagine a real festival excitement about that in winter, and a point of difference as opposed to watching yet another, you know, international qualifier away to Georgia. Or we have Azerbaijan this Saturday, which I'm looking forward to and everything, Rob. But I think the idea of the four-team group and a sense of festival might be better. So whatever about the every 2 years notion for a moment, There is something, I would say, in Wenger's point that the international calendar at the moment doesn't really work or excite many people.
Well, yeah, I mean, he's trying to get more meaningful games, remove some of those less meaningful ones. I mean, I'm speaking to you actually from Twickenham, a bit of rugby perspective on all this, which is the fact is they have the October for the autumn internationals, obviously February, March for the Six Nations, and then, you know, we've got the in June as well for those games as well, those tests. So, you know, the three clearer blocks of games. And maybe that is something that works better, because I think for now, having games in September, then October, then November, it's so disjointed, going away on international duty, going back to your clubs as well, then returning again. It could be more cohesive to actually get a block of games together. Certainly the leagues, though, don't want sort of a month off between October and November where they lose completely all their games and disruption it would cause as well to something like the Champions League as well. Perhaps a smaller window in October, then another in March makes sense. Another reason is, imagine you're a player and you don't make the squad in October for those games. Well, the next squad, this is only the tournament one in June. So you might have missed your chance to break into the squad if you've done particularly well, you know, around the turn of the year, but a manager doesn't want to take the risk in terms of selecting you yet for the national team. The March window does obviously allow that now, that final chance to maybe look at some new players before a tournament in the summer. So perhaps having an October, November window, a March window and the summer does work. So that's that part of the reconfiguration. Wenger's talking about obviously removing those less meaningful games. At the same time, he told the meeting, I'm told, last week of the FAs that he might consider a secondary World Cup for those teams that don't qualify for the main World Cup to give them games. So that would obviously create games that aren't as commercially appealing, particularly if it's the same time as the main World Cup. Well, how attractive would they be to fans to even watch on television? So it creates more infrastructure challenges as well. You've got to find venues for all these. So it's often about expansionism. And the sense is from some, it's about FIFA president Gianni Infantino wanting to be more involved in the global game. Mm. As it stands now, in part because of the pandemic, he's not been able to oversee a main FIFA World Cup since the Women's World Cup 2019. This plan, if it was approved, would see a FIFA World Cup every single year, either men's 1 year or women the next year. And that would suddenly place FIFA right at the heart of the football calendar every year, increase the power and status of FIFA as well, and of Infantino. So, you know, that's been one of the things. And you know, obviously, the consultation has brought out so many intriguing thoughts as well. The fact is so many former players are being wheeled out by FIFA on in-house video stating the case for changes to the international match calendar that ultimately lead to a World Cup every 2 years. It's worth checking out, but last week on CBS on their Champions League coverage, Peter Schmeichel was in the studio and he was put up for a FIFA press conference a few weeks ago stating the FIFA case. And he was challenged in the studio by Thierry Henry and Jamie Carragher, both saying, why are FIFA consulting us as retired players? We're not the ones there anymore. Why aren't we hearing from them speaking to the main players who are still around? And Carragher also pointed out that Wenger first approached him and he thinks he wasn't asked back for any more talks because he wasn't supportive enough.
Right, okay. Well, I think, look, all of these former players coming in and talking on FIFA's behalf should have a ticker at the bottom of the screen saying how much they've been paid for their time here, because
it's not necessarily even about how much they've been paid or not. It's actually about partly the lifestyle. They get taken to the FIFA events, they get flown out to Qatar, which might make them naturally more supportive and receptive. It gives them this role within the game still as well.
Mm.
And, you know, that's what's ringing alarm bells and quite literally around me here.
Well, look, if you need to run at any stage there, I mean, don't put your life in danger for us at any stage. There was a question there. Oh, yeah. So it's that was fascinating that you said Wenger only got around to talking to various leagues and various stakeholders maybe 3-4 weeks after. Do you have to go?
I might have to, yes, unfortunately. I'm just trying to, yes.
trying to work out if your life is in danger here or not.
Yeah. It might be an actual fire alarm, which is a... you might have a livelier scene. I can try talking to you still while walking. If you want to still, as I'm packing up, I can continue talking to you.
No, we wouldn't do that to you. Just on the rare occasion where there might be something serious. Listen, Rob Harris, wouldn't like to start to make you stay in these circumstances.
It has stopped.
It has stopped. Okay. Yeah. I didn't want that in my conscience driving home, Rob. So it was fascinating. You were talking there that like Wenger had taken a while to get around to talk to various serious enough stakeholders, various leagues and FAs, because a couple of weeks ago when this was all first launched, I remember listening to Gary Neville's podcast and Martin Tyler asked him about this. And I was, you know, as you would, Rob, I was looking forward to a full-on Neville rant and a European Super League-esque slapdown of this. And it was very interesting. He said, did he say Wenger specifically, but he said, look, I've been briefed by it. They sat us down, they made the presentation to us. And that suggested, a degree of smarts on Wenger's part and on FIFA's part that actually they obviously have picked out certain people long ahead of the FAs to get on board. And Neville, to be fair, was saying, look, I can definitely see certain plus points here. He was admittedly saying, look, I'm sitting on the fence a touch, but I'm not shooting this down necessarily. There is some good stuff in this. So even though he hasn't spoken to the FAs until quite recently, Wenger was doing some politicking somewhere along the line.
Yeah, for sure. He's sort of trying to win the backing of former players in particular. And perhaps it's so many faults in the process that caused the questions over this because, if they'd started perhaps last year by saying, let's look at the new international match calendar, how should it look, looked at the various options, and then said, this is what we've had back, now let's look at the feasibility of a biennial World Cup. Instead, they've come back and said, they've started from the point of saying, we want a biennial World Cup, and now trying to prove the case backwards. And perhaps that's what's led to the questions over the process that they're going about this, and the fact the women's game is clearly appearing to be secondary, the fact they've only brought in Jill Ellis more recently, the former US World Cup winning coach, to look at the women's game, whereas Wenger has been looking at the men's game for much longer.
Yeah. Personal question. Would you like a World Cup every 2 years? Do you feel it would diminish it in your eyes? Or would you think, look, I watch and enjoy Champions League every year. Why not?
Well, it does seem it will diminish it, I think, having a World Cup every 2 years. Already now, the Champions League group stage does have a bit of lustre taken from it. Yes, we see the shocks with Sheriff beating Real Madrid, but we still think it's time for Real Madrid to recover. But if we just point out some of the inconsistencies, the European Club Association are one of those groups opposing these plans. They are adding another 4 games to the group stage from 2024, from 6 to 10 games, which many have said actually will diminish the Champions League in some way. So they've looked to add games while they talk about the impact on player workload on this bigger World Cup more often. Because, of course, the World Cup is jumping to 48 teams as well from 2026. And not only every 2 years, but a 48-team men's World Cup as well.
Yeah, ultimately, that's the point, isn't it, Rob? We're just seeing every organisation try and cram in more and more games and take up more and more real estate. That's what's happening at the moment. There's a proper tension, certainly between UEFA and FIFA and beyond.
There is, absolutely. It's the battleground over who controls football. And we just see that with UEFA and Common Ball have linked up to hold these games between the champions of the confederations. The fact we're going to have a game between Argentina next year and Italy, the first of these games. And the fact UEFA and Common Ball are opening an office even together in London as well. So it just shows like a rival power faction building all in the battle to control football.
How likely do you think FIFA are then to get this across the line?
It's looking like they could do it. Really, it depends on, do the opponents really take it to the brink? They really carry out their threats and say they will boycott a World Cup. What do UEFA do to stop this? But it does have that momentum behind it now.
Okay. One last question, separate issue. Speaking of FIFA, I saw for the first time on Sunday they offered direct encouragement for footballers to get vaccinated. This was on Sunday, so it was the first clear statement of its kind from FIFA. We encourage COVID-19 vaccinations and endorse the WHO's position. Safe, fair, equitable access is critical in all countries. Players should not receive priority access to vaccines. So, look, the Premier League has an issue on its hand and many leagues beyond. What's your understanding of the hesitancy in dressing rooms the world over, not least in England and the Premier League?
Well, I'm here at the Leaders in Sport conference, so it's interesting being talking to club officials around here, and you get that real sense from them of how that hesitancy has grown. You've got players who may be on religious grounds, some have said that, you know, they might have a resistance to vaccines, not something that, you know, we hear from the World Health Organization. But perhaps there's been an ability for the disinformation to grow over the months in the wait for players to be able to get the vaccines, because obviously there are so many saying they shouldn't be jumping the queue and getting them, say, around March time or April, ahead of those who are older and more vulnerable as well. And I think we've also seen players thinking, well, does it really affect me? I'm not in the at-risk group if you're in the 20s, and perhaps thinking they don't want to put a vaccine into their body. But it, you know, gets me thinking how many players have painkilling jabs so often and, you know, barely think about those. They will say, obviously, they've been around for many, many more years. And some are sort of thinking, well, these COVID jabs have only been around for a year or so. So they question that, even those we know from the health authorities, they have gone through rigorous testing. We are assured that, you know, they are safe. And, you know, we've seen so many people around the world having them perfectly fine. And, you know, perhaps it's we've not seen that leadership from FIFA, even though they are in partnership with the World Health Organization to promote a vaccine message, really until the last few days. And they've said they encourage players to get vaccinated. And on top of this, we're looking ahead to the 2022 World Cup, when we had thought they might have a mandatory vaccination policy, particularly for fans. Now it looks like they could relax that and allow, say, testing instead of just mandatory vaccines.
Thanks so much, Rob.
No problem. Okay. Thank you.
Cheers. Rob Harris there from Associated Press here on The Football Show, which, as ever, Not The Ball is with thanks to Sky, all the football you love in one place across Sky Sports, BT Sport and Premier Sports. Back in a sec.
Football on Off The Ball.
With Sky. Watch every single live Premier League game on Sky Sports, BT Sport and Premier Sports.